So what the topic of this evening is, we're continuing this overarching theme of building the Buddha land. And in recent weeks and in the coming weeks in particular, we're going to be looking at creativity. And I know that Joel Malani spoke about that last week, introduced the topic and talked about... In terms of building the Buddha land, we our own creativity can help in building the Buddha land. And we're continually having an impact on the universe and continually having an impact on ourselves. There is no distinct gap between ourselves and everything else in the universe. We can't influence the universe without having an effect on ourselves and vice versa. Joel Malani also talked about the system of practice within our movement, and mentioned the topic of integration. And it's that in particular that I want to focus on in the next half hour or so. And in terms of integration, we're particularly talking about meditation, which of course you've all got some experience of, as well as, to an extent, outside meditation. There are two types of integration as far as meditation is concerned. So we have horizontal integration and vertical integration. So I want to look at horizontal integration first. So it's been said that perhaps when we turn up at the Buddha Center for the first time, that we can be a bundle of habits loosely tied together with a name and an address. So a bundle of habits loosely tied together with a name and an address. And having given that some thought and meditated a bit and thought about it over the years, I think there's quite a bit of truth in that, really. That your man or woman in the street, when they think about, you know, if you were to ask them, well, what are you? What is the self? What is your self? Probably think that they're a fairly distinct identity. You know, one thinks of oneself in quite a fixed way, I suppose. But the more you meditate, the more you practice in Buddhism, perhaps you tend to see that it's not quite that simple. The nature of oneself, the nature of self, is a little bit more subtle than that, perhaps. An example of this could be when, let's say you're wandering around Bristol, you're walking across Bristol Bridge or something like that, and you bump into a work colleague. So if you just imagine that for a second, you bump into a work colleague, and you might react to them in a certain way. You might adopt a certain facial expression, you might greet them in a certain way, and your behaviour and the language you use might be of a certain nature. However, let's just say instead of meeting a work colleague, you bumped into a social friend, somebody you were out socialising with, and how is it when you meet that person? Maybe you present just a slightly different persona. You might greet them in a different way. You might have slightly different mannerisms, slightly different language. Maybe you're a bit more smiley or what have you, a bit more jokey. So there's a slightly different aspect to yourself, perhaps. And then, let's say, instead, you bump into somebody from the Sangha, somebody you know from perhaps in this room. And again, what sort of persona do you present to this person? What sort of language do you use? What sort of facial expression? What greeting? Do you talk about different topics? So the point is, I think, that one can adopt slightly different personas in slightly different scenarios. And to an extent, that's okay. That's fine, to the extent that we're conscious of it. I became aware of that myself when doing the metta bhavana, the fifth stage of the metta bhavana, when, as you're aware, that you bring together these various different characters that you've meditated upon and try to generate love and kindness towards them. And when I was doing that initially, and I would have somebody from the Sangha, perhaps somebody I knew socially, perhaps, it felt a little bit lopsided that meeting those people in together, so a person from work, a person from social life, a person from the Sangha, it felt a bit odd that I wasn't quite sure which persona to adopt. So it may be that we have this kind of array, perhaps, of different personas. We may feel pulled in slightly different directions should we meet those three people on Bristol Bridge at the same time. So that's one aspect of these different elements of ourselves. Another aspect can be that you might notice that different aspects of ourselves take charge, take the driving seat, take the wheel at different times. So that can be, you can notice that if you tend to perhaps change your mind quite a bit. What seems like a good idea one day, a bit later on or the next day, seems like a terrible idea. What was I thinking? Why is that? Why is it, you know, one day it's a good idea, the next day is a bad idea? And it can be because different aspects of ourselves are taking charge at different times. And another thing we can do is embark on different projects and then abandon them. That's something that I used to do quite a bit. I used to get teased about. So you'd think something was a fantastic idea and you spend money on some hobby or something, buy loads of photography equipment or what have you. And then a few months later, you know, you never use it again. So there's that aspect of it. And of course, there's the masculine and feminine sides as well. And then speaking from the point of view of a man, then it can be sometimes difficult to embrace one's feminine side in some areas of society. It can be difficult to show that, or at least it can feel difficult to show it. Perhaps you can feel a little bit, you know, like you might get teased or you're worried about your sexuality or whatever it might be. So that can be a bit... So maybe our feminine side, as if we're men, you know, might not get, we might try to sort of set that aside a bit. And similarly with women, obviously I can't speak from the women's point of view, but I do remember I ran a series of courses on a couple of occasions, but the first time I ran it, it was a course on archetypes and myth and archetypes. As a part of this, I played, each evening we focused on a different area of the arts, and one particular evening we focused on music, and I played a number of different pieces of music, and we just sort of sat there and allowed our responses to arise. And one of the pieces of music I played was as those who know me won't be surprised, was from Rammstein, which is one of my favourite bands, a German industrial metal band. And Don't Get Played at the Buddha Center very often. there was something interesting that came out of it, because for me at least, because one of the women there said, as a woman, it's quite difficult sometimes to express high energy states. You know, society doesn't always permit that, or you know, it feels like society doesn't accept that in women, and so she felt it was quite difficult to express that. Perhaps that's why you see a lot of women actually at Rammstein gigs enjoying themselves and expressing those high energy sides of themselves in a healthy way. Which brings me on to another aspect, really, which is having been to a Rammstein gig sometimes, I've got a problem with my hip sometimes, and I need to use crutches or a crutch sometimes if I'm walking long distances. And if you've been to any of those arena gigs, a lot of the time the gap is like you're on a ledge, sort of looking down over, you know, you've got a very narrow gap to perch upon. And so with crutches, and you're trying to find your seat and squeezing by people, and there's all these people with leather jackets and studs and all that sort of stuff, tattoos and that. And that's just the women. but the thing is, they're really, my experience has been, really friendly. Oh, yeah, no problem, mate, I'll just get out of the way, you know, and you're squeezing by. And you're trying to wobble by on your crutches, try not to totter over the edge. But the people there are really friendly and nice. And this is absolutely true. I went to the, used to go to the Theatre Royal in Bath to see a play from time to time. And I can't remember what play it was I was going to see on this occasion, but I went with my wife, and again, I was on crutches. And it was unbelievable just how unpleasant people were and how they felt I was inconveniencing them because I was on crutches and had to squeeze by them. And all these people were tutting at me and just, I mean, it was quite extraordinary, really. So what am I saying? So what's the point? I think it can be a good thing to be able to express the various different aspects of ourselves in a healthy way. Whether it is a high energy side of ourselves, whether we might have frustrations or what have you, or we just want to jump about or what have you, then to be able to do that in a healthy way is a good thing. So it's important, I think, to have a feeling for these various different aspects of ourselves, and very important not to suppress them, not to push them over to one side. So if you're a man and you're worried about, you're expressing your feminine side, try to avoid, pushing it over to one side and suppressing it and pretending it's not there. There was another example of this, actually. I'm labouring the point slightly, maybe. But do you remember in the Eurovision Song Contest a few years ago, this rock band from Finland won? I think they were called Jordi or Geordie or something like that. Remember that? Can I pop it? No? You don't? No, not a Eurovision Song Contest? No. Okay. Well, they did. And they had these outrageous clothes and stuff like that.
I'm a Geordie, though.
Right, well, I'm surprised you're not aware of that. No. Anyway, so this rock band won, and it was quite a surprise. It's not the usual Eurovision thing. And I was listening to some DJs chatting about it when I was driving home, and they were saying how they'd met this band, and what lovely guys they were. They were all dressed horrendously with all this stuff, but what lovely, pleasant guys they were, obviously impeccable English and all that sort of stuff. And the DJs were chatting, and they were saying, it's interesting, because often you meet these sort of rock bands and... that can be quite aggressive and portray a certain persona, and are very friendly, nice chaps. Whereas often if you might meet the boy bands or the girl bands or the people who sing these lovey-dovey, love songs, can actually be quite horrible and not themselves. Can I say that in the Buddhist centre? I don't know. So again, I don't know. Maybe it's a good thing to be able to express oneself in a healthy way. Anyway. Sorry?
Even at the Buddhist
Centre, yes, that's right. So what this means then, let's go back to integration. We've got these various different aspects of ourselves, masculine, feminine, introvert, extrovert, so on and so forth. Integration means that these different aspects of ourselves come into some sort of relationship with one another. There's a communication between these different aspects of ourselves, and there's no conflict. So we endeavour to accept that it's okay to be an introvert or an extrovert, or both at different times, or to display our masculine side, our feminine side, to be passive sometimes and to be assertive sometimes, and so on. An example I have of this is the introvert-extrovert type of thing, really. Because I'm by nature an introvert, and quite happy to just sort of sit in the corner and not just with my own thoughts and so on. But I do have an extrovert side as well, and so that extrovert side likes to be the centre of attention sometimes, whereas the introvert side really doesn't want to be the centre of attention and wants to just sort of hide away. And that used to be a bit of a problem. It worked, for example, 20 years ago or so. The extrovert side of myself wanted to give talks and sort of progress career-wise and that sort of thing. And so I put myself in the position where I would be giving talks in work. And the introvert side of myself would be absolutely terrified and think, why am I doing this to myself? The result was a great deal of anxiety and discomfort, and it was very unpleasant. There was this sort of clash of these two different aspects of myself, pulling in different directions, because they didn't have any sort of relationship, there was no communication between them, and there was no understanding on my part of the various different elements of myself. So meditation can help us with this in kind of a natural way. We don't have to do anything other than meditate. I think it's just one of the natural byproducts of meditation is it helps us to become aware of some of the different elements of ourselves and helps those different elements to become in communication with one another and to be more comfortable with one another. But we can also work on this consciously as well. We can also think about it, become aware of it and reflect upon it. I'll say a bit more about this in a moment. So that was horizontal integration. And I just want to talk a little bit about Vertical integration. Well, I'm only going to quote actually what's written in this book, because Kamala Shila here in his book Meditation puts it very well. So rather than paraphrase him, I thought I'd just read it out. So Kamala Shila says, so this is in relation to vertical integration. The second aspect of integration is called vertical because we are getting into contact with our heights and our depths. We are discovering our heavens and our hells. At this stage, a completely new order of emotions, thoughts, and pictorial images may be released into our consciousness. They may be connected with significant past experiences, happy childhood memories, or perhaps painful experiences that have long been forgotten. They may well be vision-like. Sometimes people see divinely beautiful or awe-inspiring forms such as gods, demons, Buddhas, or symbolic images. Universal images coming from the heights and depths in our mind, such as the archetypes described by Carl Jung. Images like these are commonly experienced in deep meditation. Clearly, there is much hidden energy and creativity in the depths, waiting to be activated through meditation. So I think that is an important point, because as I mentioned in my own example of the introvert-extrovert thing, there was a great deal of energy there that was being wasted, or rather being turned into anxiety, and which was very unpleasant. Well, of course, that energy could be much more creatively and helpfully used. And so that's true with all sorts of integration, that we can free up energy by avoiding the conflicts that the absence of integration can cause. Kamala Shila mentioned Carl Jung there. You might be aware, familiar with Carl Jung. He was contemporary of Freud, and he particularly dealt with archetypes. So I'm going to move on to archetypes now a bit. I'm going to quote Sangharakshita. Sangharakshita, as you may be aware, was the founder of our movement. So Sangharakshita says, archetypes are all present, each and every one of them within us all. We can say we share them. We've got them all in common. And in the course of our spiritual life, especially as we practice meditation, those archetypes, these forms, in various ways, tend to emerge into consciousness. Sometimes they show themselves, at least by way of a glimpse, in dreams, in meditation, sometimes in sort of waking fantasies. So archetypes. An archetype is an original model of a person, an ideal example, a prototype upon which others can be copied, a symbol universally recognized by all. So I'm going to give you a few examples now of archetypes, so you can hopefully get a better idea of what I mean. And I'm going to use the story of the Buddha. Well, the Buddha's biography. So first of all, you may have heard of when the Buddha was about to get enlightened. He sat down for the final time before he gained enlightenment, and when he was on the verge of gaining enlightenment, Mara appeared. And Mara basically tried to prevent him from gaining enlightenment by using various different methods. And it could be said that Mara represented an aspect of the Buddha's mind, the Buddha's consciousness. But that's not really our point here. In this case, Mara represents Mara represents or is an archetype, an archetypal bad guy, you might say. And so Carl Jung, who did a lot of work on this, I guess it's about 100 years ago now, he came up with these identified various archetypes. And so the archetype he had that corresponds with Mara is our shadow side. I will say a little bit more about it later. And just for fun, and to make it also hopefully clarify things, I put Star Wars in as well. Star Wars is full of archetypes. I think they consciously did that. But not just Star Wars, lots of stories are. But Star Wars are quite well known. So is there anybody who hasn't seen Star Wars? Oh, it's full of it. That's good. Well, it's good. I don't know if it's good or not, but you know Darth Vader, do you? Anyway, so the equivalent would be Darth Vader. You know, the archetypal bad guy. Could be the Emperor, I suppose. But let's stick with Darth Vader for now. He's probably better known. So, but basically, it represents a typical sort of bad guy. Then, once the Buddha became the Buddha, gained enlightenment, and he was reflective for a bit. Anyway, he wasn't sure whether he would be able to communicate what he realized to other people. So he was pondering this. And as he was walking along the road, he bumped into Rama Sahampati, who they chatted about, and the Buddha explained his problem, his issue, and Brahma Sahampati reassured the Buddha, encouraged him to teach, because he felt that there were people that would understand. And so as a result, the Buddha did indeed go on and teach. So Brahma Sahampati. So again, he's you could say he's a mythical figure, I suppose. But nevertheless, he does represent something in this story, and what he represents is the idea of the wise older man, the sort of guy, the person you might go to get some good advice. So Carl Jung recognised that as the wise old man, and of course in Star Wars that would probably be Obi-Wan Kenobi. This wise old man character. And you can probably think of lots of stories that have that sort of character, that sort of archetype. And then another aspect of the Buddha's biography was his protection by Mochalinda, the Naga king. So I don't know whether you're familiar with this story, but it was pouring with rain as the Buddha was sitting meditating. And Mochalinda, the Naga king, who was essentially like an enormous cobra, thought he would protect the Buddha, and so he wrapped his coils round him and rose up over him so that his hood of the cobra was protecting his head, like an umbrella. And so that's Mochalinda, the Naga king. Now, Carl Jung, the corresponding Carl Jung archetype would be the idea of the young hero. Because Mochalinda could be said to represent our own vital energies. Hero. And of course, in Star Wars, we've got Luke Skywalker, haven't we? Now, I could go up and on, but because there are lots of archetypes in Star Wars, but I'll leave it there for now. I just mentioned some other key archetypes that could come up. So a typical archetype is the hero that appears in lots and lots of stories. So it could be Batman, it could be Beowulf, it could be Neo in Matrix, it could be Lancelot. It could be... there are no end of heroes. An interesting archetype is the uncivilized sidekick. Now, he crops up quite a lot. There's Enkidu in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is a very interesting read. Little John. Chewbacca, of course. So these could be said to represent our more animalistic, our more uncultivated aspects. So we've all got the aspect of ourselves inside. Well, I'm just hold your horses. The Great Mother. But you're quite right. I did have to work to find female ones. But I could argue that that's probably, you know, I can only kind of represent my own sort of masculine, coming from the masculine side. But anyway. The Great Mother, which could be either good or terrible. So we have the Earth Goddess, again, in the biography of the Buddha. We have Mahadevi in the Hindu tradition. We have Glinda, the Good Witch of the North from The Wizard of Oz. Then another one we have is the Trickster, another common archetype, crops up all over the place. Reynard the Fox, Brer Rabbit, Bart Simpson, Loki, and so on. The Wise Old Man we've already talked about. Merlin, Gandalf, Albus Dumbledore, for example. And another interesting one is the Eternal Boy, the Pure Eternus. Peter Pan is an example of this. Icarus, perhaps, could be another example. So all of these could represent some aspect of ourselves. We all, perhaps to a greater or lesser extent, have some bit of this within us. We've all got a bit of the hero inside, or a good example of a contrast. I mean, a potential conflict is the Eternal Boy and the Wise Old Man. The Eternal Boy represents sort of youthful energies, but also naivety, idealism. Whereas the Wise Old Man is, you know, has got the wisdom and it's got experience, but also can be a bit conservative and stuck in his ways. So neither one on their own are ideal. What you really want is to be able to call on those resources as and when you need them, rather than being stuck in one mode. Other ones that come up are the healer, which could be men or female, the explorer, the artist, the poet, so on and so forth. And you may find one or more of these persistent. You may find one or more of these crop up in your dreams. I'm just going to finish a bit by talking about the shadow in particular, because I think that's quite interesting. And I'm going to quote Sangha Achyuta again, the founder of our movement. He says, we all have to encounter the shadow. This is the dark, unpleasant side of ourselves, the side that we'd rather forget, the side which appears in dreams, for instance, as a black dog. We want to get rid of him, but we can't. We have to face, to come to terms with, even to assimilate, this darker side of ourselves. Just as the Buddha faced and overcame Mara and his hosts, and here, just as in the case of Mara and his hosts, repression is no solution. The shadow, or the contents represented by the shadow, must be saturated, as it were, with awareness and resolve. Just as the Buddha didn't start emitting flames himself to counteract the flames of Mara's hosts, didn't start throwing stones himself, when these things touched the aura of the Buddha, they were just turned into flowers, transformed, transmuted. So that's the sort of thing we have to do with our shadow, the darker side of our nature. Just see it, look at it, recognize it, even accept it, and then transform and transmute it into what the tantric condition calls a guardian, a protector. So the shadow can be those bits of ourselves that we suppress. So it could be, as for me, for example, if I were to suppress my feminine aspects of my personality for whatever reason, that could get shoved into the shadow. Or if I wanted to suppress the more extrovert sides of myself because it makes me feel uncomfortable, again, that could be shoved into the shadow. And we really need to explore that and open up to that and embrace that rather than trying to repress these things. I do have an example of this, actually, and funnily enough, this happened in my meditation, and it was a dog, as Sangha Achyuta said. I was meditating along quite happily, and all of a sudden this dog sort of seemed to appear in my meditation, a very fierce, aggressive dog, and it was quite a shock. And crikey, I was taken aback. And but on reflection, it seemed to me that this represented an aspect of myself. And just like a dog, a fierce dog, it can be actually very useful. You know, dogs can be man's best friend, they can be helpful, they can be protective if you make friends with them. And so it seemed to me that what I needed to do was, rather than be afraid of this aspect of myself, which probably I think represented anxiety and nervousness, was rather just sort of embrace it and try to make a relationship, try to become friends. And then this energy can be converted and transmuted into something more useful. However, a shadow or any other such thing, any of these sorts of things that we've talked about here, archetypes and so on, is a model of our mental processes. Being a model, by definition, it's not the thing itself. So it's not going to be perfectly accurate, but it does. It's a useful tool. So just to summarise then, integration can help us to transform some of our shortcomings. It can help us to mobilise all those various different aspects of ourselves. But clearly we can't do this without an awareness of ourselves, without an awareness of these different aspects of ourselves, which again is where meditation comes in very useful. It's important to try to come to terms and accept ourselves, which is it's a challenging thing to do, I certainly find, to be able to accept all those different aspects of ourselves, all those bits that we really don't like and don't want to have. It's a difficult thing to do. But that enables us to mobilise and utilise these different bits of ourselves. Helps us to transcend our limited selves. So rather than being stuck in one mode, which could be, I don't know, I had an example of this the other day at work, where I was at a meeting and there were two guys there who were trying to be the king. They were both trying to be the king. They were both alpha males, you know, trying to be alpha males. And talking over one another with the greatest respect, blah, blah, blah. And it was quite amusing, really, but not really very productive or helpful. But that was the mode these guys tended to operate, at least in that scenario. And we all have default modes of operating, default ways of being. But sometimes, to be most useful, sometimes it's good to be able to lead a situation when it's called for, when it's suitable, when we might be qualified. And sometimes it's good to just to follow a suitable leader. So to be able to adapt to the scenario, to meet the need, whatever it's needed, in the appropriate way is a good thing to do. So if we've got that flexibility, if we've got an understanding of all those different aspects of ourselves and can call on those different aspects of ourselves, that's very good. It's much better than being stuck in one particular mode of operating, where perhaps we're always passive or we're always too assertive. So we don't have, my little note said, we don't have to be king all the time. Or queen, of course. So all this is essential, I think, if we are to develop and grow, if we are to work in harmony together, and if we are, therefore, to build the Buddha Lab.